You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. Despite all of our modern science and medicine, knowledge about the female body is seriously lacking. Myths abound, and even women themselves often don't understand how their bodies work, thanks to men's takeover of what became the medical establishment. It's because of these myths and misunderstandings, everything from the idea that pubic hair is dirty, to the belief that having sex while pregnant could hurt the baby, to the trend of steaming the vagina, that Dr. Jen Gunter recently published a book called The Vagina Bible. In it, she covers everything from STDs to douching to yeast infections to so-called hygiene. I spoke with the Canadian OBGYN over the phone not only about vaginas, but about all sorts of ways we are sold unhelpful products for and information about our bodies. Here's that interview. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure.
So my first question is, what drove you to write an entire book about the vagina?
Well, you know, there's so much misinformation about the vagina and the vulva. I mean, so many people can't talk about the kind of sex they want to have. They don't know their parts. There's, you know, all these competing layers of misinformation, like wellness, medicine excluding women, you know, news media that are desperate to have headlines with the word vagina, because that's clickbait. I mean, it was Gwyneth Paltrow who said, you know, if it's the word vagina, it's a cultural firestorm. And she is correct there. That does get clicks. And, you know, with our 24/7 news cycle, these headlines go around faster and faster. And it's very easy for people to be exposed to misinformation and very easy for them to believe it because of this sort of illusory truth effect. We all mistake repetition for accuracy. So I just kind of felt that women needed a textbook, and I was going to write it, and here I am.
Right on. I mean, I'm always amazed. I'm almost 40, and I'm still amazed at how little I know. You know, I'll find out new information and realize something I had assumed was true all along was not at all true. And it makes me so angry, thinking about, you know, how misinformed I was when I was younger about not just, you know, my vagina, but about my reproductive cycle and so on and so forth. And it makes me mad for other women too, of course. Why in this day and age, with all of our supposedly modern science, are people still so ill-informed about the female body?
Well, you can't know everything about it, right? Because, I mean, I don't know everything about, like, lungs or the heart, but I know a lot. So, I mean, I think that, and even for me, I'm still learning things. So I haven't read everything about, well, actually, it's probably not learning that much new about the vagina and vulva. But I guess what I'm saying is, like, the what I would consider like a really good layperson's working knowledge is really actually hard to get to people because we have all these social mores that makes it impossible for people to talk about the vagina and vulva without it being rude or ignorant, you know, being rude or shameful. And of course, there's nothing shameful about your normal body. But you know, the patriarchy wants women to not talk about their bodies. That's how you keep people oppressed. So I think that you have this combination of the societal inability to talk about it without shame. You have, you know, the fact that we have such low quality sex education, that we have this idea that not only we have low quality sex education, but we don't teach people the mechanics of good sex, right? Like how to have an orgasm, how to do these things. So then what happens is people, because this is shameful, people have to go to, you know, maybe sites that are less accurate to get information because that's the only place that's talking about it. So I think there's all these cultural pressures. And then, you know, medicine has not done a good job of listening to women. There are many things that are understudied. And then you have wellness coming in to exploit those gaps. So, you know, I can see how it all happens. And, you know, if you look at what was a trusted resource for a lot of women, our bodies ourselves, it has a lot of misinformation in it. you know, it was written by people who aren't doctors in the 70s. So this was before we had a lot of the information that we have about the lower reproductive tract, because this was before DNA technology. So we couldn't know a lot of things that we have now. And, you know, I mean, whenever people say, well, why do women put garlic or yeast in their vagina, garlic or yogurt in their vagina, that's recommended in our bodies ourselves.
And by wellness, when you say wellness, who are you talking about there? You know, what's the wellness kind of industry about?
Well, I guess, you know, people who are making claims about health, but they have not backed it up with any science, and they're offering it under the guise of some kind of natural therapy. Right. So if things work, they become medicine. So I think that's a really important thing to claim, to state. So, you know, this idea that this season you can use charcoal, the next season you use turmeric, and the season after that you use CBD, you know, that it's in everything. These sort of products that are supposed to help you are in everything, and then they disappear, and then it's something else. And, you know, medicine doesn't work that quickly. We can't study things and possibly in 3 months know, you know, that we should move on to the next thing. So, you know, wellness is exploiting those gaps. And it's always fascinating to me that people give wellness a pass, but they don't give pharma a pass. I mean, I'm no friend of big pharma, but, you know, at least you can walk into a plant that's making birth control pills and it'll contain what it says. If you go into a plant, you know, making making supplements, you have no idea if it's going to be what it claims or not. You know, up to 70% of them can be adulterated, and they've got no studies to show that anything works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I am myself very skeptical of big pharma and think that they sell women and everyone broadly a lot of drugs that have not been well tested and that, you know, are harmful or potentially harmful. But I also think, by the other hand, you're right that there's all of these trends that seem to go through cycles, and the people selling those trends seem to really, you know, prey on women.
Right. Also, wellness doesn't study anything. In my opinion, they're worse than big pharma because they do nothing. They just make claims. They just make claims. They don't actually do anything. So I think that people have to view them with that same eye. You should look at wellness with the same eye that you look at pharma.
Right. But I mean, do you see any kind of legitimacy to, you know, natural treatments or home remedies or something like that? I mean, I just want to make sure. I assume you're not just conflating wellness with, you know, avoiding or wanting to avoid pharmaceuticals.
So I don't ever recommend anything that's natural. I recommend things that work. So calcium supplementation can help women with PMS. So I will recommend that based on studies, right? So I think that's really important. So if something is effective, it doesn't matter what it is. As long as it's safe, we recommend it. So mm-hmm. I totally push back about this idea of natural therapy. That's a marketing term. That's not a medical term. I don't want to give my patients marketing. I want to give my patients medicine. I want to help them get better. And, you know, there are many, many different treatment options, but this idea that natural is better is a fallacy. It's not based in anything factual. And certainly, I mean, there's a story going around Twitter today of some professor who decided that he was going to make tincture of elderberry for instead of getting a flu shot, and he gave himself cyanide poisoning.
Goodness.
Yeah. So, you know, because unripe elderberries apparently have cyanide. So there you go. So I'm just saying that, you know, therapies that work, work, and therapies that don't. And so people should be given those facts, and they should be given the risks and the benefits, and then they can make those choices. But this idea that I'm going to tell someone to use something that can't work, I mean, that's malpractice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, I guess the key here is having good information and, like you say, facts and access to information so that women can make their own informed choices.
Absolutely. And that's not something that anybody who's selling anything natural does. They promote fear about traditional medicine, about evidence-based medicine. They're using fear. Anybody who uses fear to sell does not have your best interests at heart.
Hmm. I wanted to move on to a different aspect of the vagina that you go over in your book. I was really relieved to see that you included a section on pubic hair removal. Because I find this trend of waxing or shaving off all of your pubic hair you know, weird, unnecessary, time consuming, but also, you know, like harmful in ways. And of course, this is a gendered trend, right? Women don't expect women to get rid of all of their pubic hair, whereas women seem to, or a lot of women, I should say, seem to believe they must, lest their partners, you know, think that it's gross or whatever. And, you know, I'm saying that, you know, I don't know any men who find pubic hair gross. That's not been my experience with my partners. So luckily, I can't say how accurate that is. I'm just assuming. But where is this pressure coming from, first of all?
I don't know. It's actually interesting. I mean, I'm dating. I have a couple of, like, dudes who, like are up front, oh, I manscape. I'm like, I don't really need to know that. I mean, like, you do you. Those are your genitals. Like, don't do it for me. Like, if you think you look better that way, great. But I don't care.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so I don't have any data, but I do believe that it's that complete pubic hair removal is probably more common in women who partner with men. That would be my guess. But I don't have literature to back that up. That would just be my best guess on what I've seen. And I think that there is this, certainly this cultural pressure for heterosexual women, especially, that there's something wrong with having pubic hair. I mean, I literally, when I tell women, because I see a lot of skin complications from pubic hair removal. So I at least see a lot of chronic itch, I see injuries. And when I tell many women that pubic hair is normal, like, they actually have a look of disgust on their face. And which is fascinating, because you would never say to someone, well, your eyebrows are normal. And they go, yeah, like, it's normal to have eyebrows, right? Like, you know, we evolve for a reason. We have all these things for a reason. And so I go through and I explain why it's there. But, you know, society has trends, and we've had a weird relationship with pubic hair for a long time, especially female pubic hair. I found it fascinating that no Greek statues have female pubic hair carved on them. The men do. I mean, I spent a lot of time looking at statues in museums. I mean, so it's fascinating to me, and I don't have the reason. You know, there's certainly lots of different ideas, but on the other hand, people get to modify their bodies how they want to. You know, I dye my hair. That's a body modification, the hair on my head. Some people get their ears pierced. Some people get their nose pierced. Some people get their tongue pierced. You know, there's risks and benefits to all body modifications. The benefit is you like it. But there are risks. And with pubic hair removal, there are very specific risks. And I think that the majority of women who remove their pubic hair never think about those risks. You know, they just sort of think it's natural to remove it, I guess. And so then they're shocked when they have a complication.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, pubic hair actually serves a purpose, more than one purpose. What are some common myths that you hear about pubic hair, and what is the truth?
Yeah, so the big myth I hear is that it's dirty. And I was like, well, that's the exact opposite. It's sort of a protective mechanism, right? You know, that would be like calling your eyelashes dirty. So, you know, I use a lot of analogies with, like, eyelashes, because eyelashes are a sign of beauty, right? Mm-hmm. So I say that they trap dirt and debris, so they actually protect the skin underneath from being exposed to irritants. It probably traps moisture, because the vulvar skin has a higher humidity. So that helps to keep it from drying out. Definitely women who remove their pubic hair, we see a greater trend for developing itchy skin, and, you know, dryness makes your skin more likely to be itchy. And pubic hair may have a role in sexual function, because, you know, each pubic hair is attached to a nerve ending. So when you tug on it, you get more stimulation, right? So, you know, there's been no data looking at, you know, how does that alter sexual function for women? And then finally, there is some, you know, disputed potential link with transmission of viral sexually transmitted diseases. And that certainly does make sense. I mean, when you remove your pubic hair, you're creating microtrauma to the skin. And, you know, when I do surgery, if I shave someone beforehand, they're more likely to get a surgical site infection, because the shaving has caused microtrauma. So, you know, that would make sense that if you've recently removed your pubic hair, and then you have, you know, you rub your genitals up against someone who's shedding HPV or herpes, you're probably more likely to catch it. So, you know, knowing all those risks, then people make the decisions that work for them. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, just think, wouldn't you want to know in advance? And I always think about my kid's pediatric dentist has a big poster about the risks of tongue piercing, because I didn't know this till I saw the poster. But if you pierce your tongue, you're more likely to get gum erosion and chipped teeth. And isn't that better for you to know before you make that choice with your body?
Of course. Another trend that I'm troubled by these days is the trend of vaginoplasty, or rejuvenation, it's sometimes called, wherein women are getting cosmetic surgery mostly on their vulvas. Right. You know, I guess I think it's harmful, first of all, just to suggest to women that there's something wrong with their vulvas. And it seems like in general, there's no, you know, most of the time, in any case, there's no real purpose to this except for some kind of, you know, pressure or desire to have a vagina that looks a particular way. Maybe presumably to satisfy a male gaze. I wonder, what are the stats on these surgeries? You know, are they actually becoming more popular?
Oh, yeah, they're definitely increasing. And, you know, the American College of OBGYN specifically says that we have no long-term data on, you know, on these procedures, and, you know, they don't recommend them. Obviously, that doesn't stop people from doing it. And I think that it's important to sort of, there's a couple of different groups here. So there's sort of this overall rejuvenation, that there's something, you know, all tissues get a little bit lax with age, right? Like everything drops a little bit, like that's aging. And, you know, I think this idea that somehow the cosmetic appearance of your vulva is going to have some kind of, you know, if somebody's judging you for your vulva, they've got a bit of a problem. I mean, I think we have to be super clear on that. Somebody should be, if they're lucky enough to see you naked, they should be worshiping it. Like, that's really how it should be. And so, you know, it's this idea that somehow if there's an issue with sex, it's always the woman's fault. Right. So I think that the rejuvenation speaks to that. A lot of the procedures for rejuvenation actually involve significantly tightening up the vagina, which leads to pain with intercourse. Right. I mean, why shouldn't we fix the, if there's a problem with sex, why not fix the aging penis? Right. Like, you know, I'm just saying. So there's that. But there's also this trend of procedures amongst very young girls, right, or young women who want to have labiaplasty. So they want to have their labia made smaller. And this is a very concerning trend, because these are women who are sort of saying that their labia are giving their symptoms, and they're not. A normal size labia does not produce symptoms. I mean, men sit on scrotums and a penis and they manage, right? So you're thinking about an extra millimeter of tissue is not going to have that impact. And so we're seeing women who, I mean, I there's this term which I'm just shocked by, that some men will tell girls that they have outy vaginas. That means their labia minora are longer than their labia majora, and somehow that's ugly. So, you know, this idea is harmful in, I mean, so many ways. Obviously, you can leave women with body image issues, but 50% of women are built that way. Like, half of women are built that way. This isn't some, like, atypical variant. This is, like, the norm. Okay. And the labia are part of your sexual response cycle. So they engorge, they have erectile tissue, they have specialized nerve endings. And when you tug on the labia, you pull the clitoral hood. So this is all part of your sexual response. And so this idea that that should be smaller, I mean, that's the equivalent of telling a man he should make his penis smaller so it looks better in jeans. Like, could you imagine a world where people would say that? And I mean, no. So that's why, and we see mothers bringing their daughters in. And I mean, it's in the United States, it's a crime to do labial reduction on a woman who's under the age of 18. It's considered female genital mutilation, and rightly so, you know? So it's, and what bothers me is that there are plastic surgeons who advertise this surgery so women can look sleeker in yoga pants.
Wow. Yeah, the whole thing is really upsetting, so I'm really glad that you've addressed this. I think that, you know, people think of it as just something cosmetic, and I think a lot of women kind of, you know, lie to themselves or have been lied to and so believe that it'll make sex better somehow. So, yeah, I'm glad to correct those misconceptions. I don't want women to hate their bodies, obviously.
You know, it's fascinating to me the things that women will do because they've taken on all the blame of the relationship, you know, that it's obviously all their fault, and it's all their vulva's fault. Like, if they could just be better. Right. And it's heartbreaking. You know, that it's really a form of emotional abuse, right, in a relationship to do that to someone. And then when they see, you know, images of celebrities talking about it, or, you know, like some celebrity was on talking about how she made her vagina perfect, like a little, like a peach, and she was like a teenager again. I mean, you know, I'm 50. I don't want my vulva to be like a teenager's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really upsetting and maddening, because it sort of, I feel like what we do too often, you know, in broader society and culture, but also in our relationships with men, is that men sort of always get to be positioned as normal. So the norm. So anything that is happening to them, anything that they're doing, what they're experiencing in bed, you know, in terms of our sexual relationships, that's all normal and fine. And we need to kind of conform to that. So if he's, you know, not interested in us, or he can't get an erection, or whatever it is, it's our fault and there's something wrong with us and we need to change it and fix this. And it's so stressful and it's so much pressure, and it's also just not true.
Oh, I have super curly hair, and I once chemically straightened my hair because the person I was with, you know, kept telling me how much better I'd look with straight hair. I took the bait.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't say that I haven't, you know, fallen to this as well. It's really sad that, and, you know, especially when women are kind of doing these things, making these changes in ways that don't make sex more pleasurable for them, you know, and in some cases it's more painful and more uncomfortable or even dangerous. And, you know, supposedly this is what they're being told or they're believing is sexual empowerment or female empowerment, or, you know, they're repeating this lie that, oh, well, this is going to make sex better. And it's sort of like, well, better for who?
Yeah. I mean, and the thing is that, I mean, obviously, because there's no biological way it's going to make sex better, you know, like a tighter vagina doesn't make sex better. There's no studies that show that, right? Like, you know, it's fascinating that you look at, you know, I quoted some of this data in the book, that if you look at, you know, over time, you know, after children, there's, you know, really no change in, you know, sexual satisfaction. I mean, overall, unfortunately, sexual satisfaction for women in heterosexual relationships is pretty low to begin with, right? But it doesn't really get worse after having kids. It stays the same. And I mean, that kind of, you know, and that's kind of interesting to me, because we do see a lot of people who do have significant, you know, changes to their body after delivery. But what that tells me is probably the most important thing for a satisfying sexual relationship is probably a caring, loving, attentive partner in the way that you need. Right. Mm-hmm. That it's all about, you know, someone who loves you for you, not about who loves you for a specific body part. That would be my guess.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, so, yeah, I'm shocked to hear these kinds of really kind of nonsensical, old fashioned myths still circulating, not only around vaginas, but also around things like pregnancy and childbirth. So, like, for example, this idea that you shouldn't have sex when you're pregnant because it might hurt the baby. Like, that's still something that people believe. Or, you know, that you can't get pregnant after 35, which, you know, I don't know all the science around that, but it's being debunked all the time by all of these women that I know who are still getting pregnant and having babies despite the fact that they're 40. You know, what's behind those particular myths that I mentioned? I mean, is there any legitimacy to them?
Well, no, I mean, there are. I mean, I think some of it's because we don't talk about these things openly. I think some of it is because science journalism is not so good. Like, people translate, you know, the drop in fertility after 35, which definitely happens, to not being able to get pregnant. And, oh, then the scary headlines, you know, women will be barren after the age of 30. Like, you know what, you know, as well as I do, the headlines become fantastical, even if the content's great. And so people are exposed to this misinformation, and sometimes the data is hard to explain, right? Like, it's hard to explain, like, you know, well, the difference between fertility rates with IVF versus IUI versus trying on your own, you know, infertility therapies versus on your own. So some of the science is complex. So I think there's that, but there's also all these purity myths too. And so it's sometimes hard to tell where one begins and one ends. Like, society loves to discard menopausal women. So this idea that as you age, your fertility, you know, you become a dried up old hag who can't get pregnant, you know, that serves the patriarchal myth, right? So there's little effort in a lot of environments correcting that. You know, I think the whole, like, treating pregnant women as if they're porcelain dolls is, you know, is also part of that patriarchal myth, right? Like that your only role in life is to reproduce. You must, you know, God forbid we take care of you before you get pregnant, but now you're pregnant, you really count. And so, yeah, I mean, yeah, this idea that you can't have sex when you're pregnant isn't true. And I mean, obviously, if you're having a bleeding problem, you're having a high risk pregnancy, that's completely different. But for a, you know, a normal low risk pregnancy, if you want to have sex, and if you don't, don't. Yeah, it's the, and myths are hard to undo, right? Like people still believe 8 glasses of water a day is a thing.
Is that not a thing?
It's not. Debunked. It's totally not a thing. It's debunked in so many places. The British Medical Journal took it on. The New York Times has taken it on. That actually came about because in the 1960s, they were trying to figure out like how much actual water a day total people needed. And it was equivalent to 8 glasses of water. But what everybody forgets is almost all of that comes from food.
Oh,
right. So it was never 8 glasses of water. It was the equivalent in everything that you consume through the day. As long as you're not an elderly person who may have some disrupted thirst mechanisms in a hot environment, you know, drink when you're thirsty. So, yeah, I mean, we still every time I write about the 8 glasses of water a day myth, I get like the worst like hate mail. I'm like, who do you think I'm like standing up for? Like anti big water? Like what? Like, what is my incentive to, you know, what's your conspiracy theory here? Like, I want to know.
I mean, it just goes to show how defensive people get when they've invested in something for a long time, right?
It's like a religion. So once people believe these myths, it's truly like telling someone Santa Claus doesn't exist and they really believe Santa does. You know, so yeah, they're very invested in it. And that's, I think, a really hard thing. Like we want to believe what we want to believe. And I mean, obviously there's not a lot of huge harm to drinking 8 glasses of water a day, but you'll go to the bathroom a lot more. And you know, we see women who think they have bladder control problems, you know, cause they're going to the bathroom like 15 times a day. So they come in cause they think they have overactive bladder. And then when you actually get them to do a bladder diary, you're like, no, your bladder is doing what it's supposed to do given the amount of water you're drinking. Every time you go to the bathroom, you're emptying 12 ounces. Like that's pretty full. You don't have overactive bladder. You have an appropriately acting bladder. If you don't want to pee 150 ounces, because you know, your bladder starts to tell you have to go to the bathroom when you're at 4 to 6 ounces, right? So if you're gonna drink 120 ounces, you're gonna have to go to the bathroom, you know, at least 10 times a day.
Mm-hmm. This is a true story about my life.
You know, and if that's okay for you, that's fine. But I'm just saying, like, you know, you don't have to drink that much. So,
I mean, I'm not forcing myself to drink. I think I must drink about 3 liters of water a day, but it's genuinely because I'm thirsty. But it does mean that I have to pee all the time. And so I have gone to the doctor and been like, do I have something wrong with me? And she's like, well, how much water do you drink? How much coffee do you drink? Right. Do you drink alcohol? And I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, because all of that adds up, right? You're not just having the water, you're having like the 3 glasses of water. Well, maybe not 3 glasses of water, but you don't. So, you know, like, so yeah. So, and that's really, I mean, I get people all the time who think they have a bladder condition. I'm like, no, I'm just looking at the water bottle under their chair. And I'm like, well, how much does that hold? Oh, 80 ounces. Okay. How many of those do you drink a day? 3. Okay. I mean, you're going to pee because your bladder's working. Good news is your bladder's working great.
Totally. That's how the body works. I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about this. Post 35 pregnancy, I mean, is there a danger in having kids or, you know, giving birth, I should say, when you're 40 or in your late 30s? Or, you know, is it very rare? Is it like you do need to panic if you're 35 and you haven't gotten pregnant yet and you want to?
Well, I don't really do, I don't do obstetrics anymore, so I might not be your best source on that. But I can tell you that when you're 30 to 30, so when you're first, the risk of infertility rises with age. So it's not that it drops off a cliff at 35. So at 30 to 34, your risk of infertility is 16%. So 16% of women will be infertile. At 40 to 44, it's 64%, right? And so, you know, by age 40, Each cycle, your chance of getting pregnant on your own is 5%. And at the age of 30, your chance of getting pregnant each cycle is about 20%, right? Mm-hmm. So fertility definitely goes down. But, you know as well as I do that if 64% of women can't get pregnant between the ages of 40 and 44, that means a third can. So that's, I mean, obviously, if you're trying to get pregnant, those numbers might not be totally reassuring, but still, you know, 30% of women are not having any infertility issues at that age, but you don't know obviously which percentage you're going to be in. So, so I think that you just have to give people the numbers and then they can think about it. Telling people that we have a fertility crisis is obviously not useful because then that is also, again, fear is not a good way to motivate people, or and it's hard for people to think, right? When you have fear, you make decisions that maybe you wouldn't make. So yeah, fertility does drop, and certainly, you know, infertility therapy gets much harder sort of over the age of 43 if you want to use your own eggs. So these are things for people to consider. But so that's, you know, that's about the extent of my knowledge on the fertility stuff, because I'm certainly not a fertility expert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, I think a big part of the problem there is, I mean, you talked about fear and we touched on this earlier, is this sort of idea that women are useless unless they're reproducing, you know, they become irrelevant, dried up, old hags, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great myth that, you know, that menopausal women are useless, right? So we used to say that, oh, you know, everybody used to die at the age of 50, so menopause is sort of not really a thing. And that's obviously not true, actually. Life expectancy was never 50. It's just that's a bad way to average it out, right? Because if you look at all the people that died at 6 months and 1 year of age, right? So the mortality was so high early on that sure, on average, life expectancy might have been 40 to 45, but there's plenty of people living after 50. All the people who didn't die off, you know, in their early years are living long lives. So women have been menopausal since the beginning of time. I mean, literature is filled with old, you know, the old crone, right? In literature, you know, Greek mythology has all these, you know, old wise women. So, you know, menopausal women have been around for ages. It's just, they're often erased from history. And then that, you know, makes us think that our only worth is, you know, when our uterus is, you know, functioning in a very specific manner.
Mm-hmm. So on another topic, last month, you spoke out after Twitter wouldn't allow your publisher to use the word vagina in ads, which of course is awkward considering the word vagina is in the title of your book. I found that pretty surprising, especially because, you know, there's pornography on Twitter. But, yeah. How did Twitter respond when you asked them why they were censoring the word vagina in promotional tweets?
Well, they never responded to me because, you know, why would they do that? They did respond when the BBC called them, fancy that. And they said that, you know, we'd either made a mistake or it was human error or it was profane. It was like, well, none of those things are true. I mean, we didn't make a mistake. When we took out the words vagina and vaginal, the tweets were accepted. Those words aren't profane. So they offered a non-explanation. And I think it's fascinating that also one of the three words we couldn't get approved in a promotional tweet, vagina, vaginal, and OBGYN.
Wow.
Yeah. So my whole field is apparently profane, according to Twitter.
They basically just lied. They weren't even honest about the fact that they weren't intentionally censoring these words.
Right. I mean, they could have easily said, we have, artificial intelligence that sorts through these things, and clearly we need to change our algorithms. Thank you for bringing this to our attention. We're working on it. That's all they had to say. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, and it's such an easy fix. They could easily have verified accounts from publishers, right? Because there's textbook publishers, there's all kinds of people that publish books with, you know, why should we have to use euphemisms? That's part of how we're here, right? Is forcing people to use euphemisms. They could easily have verified accounts so people can use the words, and they've proven that they're going to use them in an appropriately educational manner. But, you know, no.
So did they change that? You know, are you allowed to use the word vagina in your Twitter ads now or no?
No, we're still having multiple ads getting rejected.
Wow.
Yeah, so nothing changed.
Ridiculous. And, you know, what do you think this says more broadly? You know, like, why are people more comfortable with words like pussy, which I hate that word, than, you know, the word vagina?
Because if you force people to speak in euphemisms, then you are pushing the agenda that there's something shameful about having a vagina and vulva. And this idea that people are squeamish about it, I mean, that must be because everybody in the boardroom is sophomoric and immature, right? I mean, if there was a grown-up woman in there, I really just can't believe that this wouldn't have been solved. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's a systematic reflection of the fact that, that you know, women are excluded, that there's just glass ceilings everywhere, you know? And, like, what bad, like I think it's offensive to speak in euphemisms when you can use the actual word. I mean, it's one thing if whatever turns you on in the bedroom, sure, that's your business, right? But if we're talking about adult grown-up communications and we can't use the word, there's something wrong with that.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd love to go down and have a chat with the people at Twitter, but I doubt that will happen.
So would I.
Yeah, so many reasons, right? Like, let's line up the list.
Yeah. okay. And, you know, I'll let you go shortly. I wonder, what's the number one piece of advice you'd give to women wanting to get legit information about their vaginas and bodies more broadly?
Well, I think that I would say be very mindful of your internet hygiene, because where you go can really affect what you get. And the problem is there can be people who are really trying to give you information. They're trying their best, but they're actually spreading misinformation. And then there's also people who are giving you the illusion that they're helping you, but they're purposely doing it. Like, there's this Instagram influencer with over 100,000 followers who tells her followers not to get pap smears because your body will know when there's an abnormal cell. Yeah. So I tell people that they should start, you know, with trusted sources that have been vetted. So medical professional societies. So if you go to the American College of OBGYN and you search within that site, you're going to start with you want to start your search with really reliable information and then work out from there, right? So get the first piece of information from experts that have vetted the information, that have had to disclose their bias, you know, where nobody's going to get their one personal agenda pushed through. Like, there's a really good sources of basic information there. I would say the National Institute of Health actually has good information, and I hope that I'm a trusted resource for many women as well.
And finally, where can people buy the Vagina Bible?
They can buy it everywhere. They can buy it on Amazon. They can buy it in independent bookstores. They can buy it from Barnes & Noble. They can buy it everywhere. And they can get an Audible version, and they can get a Kindle version, and they can get – it's in every platform you can think of. And it's going to be published in 15 different territories. So that's apparently that's the publishing word, territories. I keep saying countries, and they keep reminding me territories. So, it's going to be translated to Chinese, into Russian, into Polish, into Czech, into Greek, into Spanish, into Portuguese. That's pretty cool.
Awesome. That's great to hear. And, yeah, thank you again for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it. And good luck with the rest of your you're very busy weeks to come, I'm sure.
Thank you so much. Thanks. You take care and let me know when this comes out so I can promote it.
I definitely will. Okay. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You just heard an interview with Dr. Jen Gunter, an OBGYN, women's health advocate, and New York Times columnist. Her new book is The Vagina Bible. To learn more about her work, please visit drjengunter.com. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. You can find us online at feministcurrent.com, tweet at us at Feminist Current, or send us an email at info@feministcurrent.com. We are hosted by Libsyn, and you can subscribe to the Feminist Current podcast anywhere you like to listen. iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, TuneIn, Spotify, and beyond. You can even give us 5 stars and a review on iTunes. Show the world radical feminism is worth listening to. Feminist Current is produced and edited by myself, Megan Murphy, out of Vancouver, BC. If you enjoyed this podcast, consider making a donation to support our work. Just visit feministcurrent.com and click the donate button.